Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Bishop from The Economist, at Matt Bish on Twitter. And first of all, very excited to see so many fellow Brits here who've obviously, now the lovely rain has stopped, have had to shelter from the unbearable heat by coming indoors like this, like me and Cindy. I think the issue we're going to discuss over the next hour is one of the defining issues of our generation, that whether we can build a better world that uses all the expertise and learnings that we've had from the business world to actually solve some of the biggest social problems and environmental problems that the planet faces. I think we've all moved beyond the point where we want to check in our heart at the door when we go to work, or we check in our brain when we get involved in social issues that we care about. And these two silos have been broken down. The world is all coming together in ways that I think create massive opportunity, but also all sorts of challenges to how existing practices in both the social sector and the business sector took place. And to discuss how we actually make the most of this tremendous moment to actually deliver the promise that the coming together of philanthropy, of social change, of capitalism, you know, I think is what we're trying to get at today. And we have three great speakers to lead our conversation. At the far end, Neil Powell, who's an ex-ad man who is now a full-time social entrepreneur and artist. To my immediate right, Margaret Keane, who is executive creative director at Saatchi, and has been involved in a lot of their attempts to get clients and causes working together. And then on my left is Cindy Gallup, who defines definition, as she will explain when she starts speaking a bit later on. I'm going to start quickly with Neil, who's going to show us a video. We're going to have a video from Margaret and then a few words from Cindy, and then we'll get stuck into the tough questions that this poses. So, Neil.
Thanks. Thanks. Thanks, Matthew. Can everyone hear me? Is that good? Yeah? Sitting room only. That's thank you. That's great. Thanks, Matthew. Thanks, panelists. Thanks, South by Southwest. And thanks for all of you guys showing up today. I'm Neil Powell. I'm the founder and creator of The Information Blanket. The Information Blanket is a swaddling-sized blanket that, and I'm going to move around a little bit because I'm going to pass these out. Sure, yeah, you can just, we've got two versions here, one that's in a language that you probably won't be able to read, and then the other is in English. The Information Blanket was created out of a briefing from UNICEF to help combat infant mortality. And I've got a little bit of a video that I'm going to show you. It's about 3 minutes long, and I think that'll do a much better job of explaining exactly what we're about than I can, and then we can dive into any questions that you might have. Volume up. Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Great. Well, thank you, Neil. That's a good introduction to it. We'll come back and talk more about what you're doing and the business model you have for doing that. Margaret, quick introduction from you.
Hi, guys. I'm Margaret Keane from Saatchi LA. I'm the executive creative director there with my partner, Chris Adams. Thank you guys for being here. This is an amazing turnout. I think we're all pretty humbled by it. Thanks for everybody. All of our friends and family are here as well. I'm honored to be on this panel with these guys. I mean, that's just, you know, when I saw that come out the first time, Neil's Blanket, I was so, I was jealous. It was just such a phenomenal idea. You know, as a creative person and somebody who's been working in this field for so long, to see somebody come up with such a breakthrough idea is pretty phenomenal. So we had a great lunch. I wish you guys could have been there yesterday, a great roundtable, and we were fired up and we were talking about all this stuff. And it's so great to know that there are people like-minded out there who are all trying to do the same thing, and I think that's what this panel is about today. I've been doing this for about 20 years, working at Shy at Day for almost 20 years in L.A. and then switching over to Saatchi. And sort of one of my main goals is to try and bring large, you know, Fortune 500 companies into the causal conversation. That's been something I've been pretty committed to, as probably all of you have, because you're here today. And it's an interesting journey, and it's a lot of clients and a lot of conversations. It was something we talked about yesterday. I'd love for you guys to really think about, you know, any questions that we can answer at the end, because I think we talked about yesterday that we really want to help you guys fulfill your dreams with regard to, you know, any clients, corporations, partnerships that you're trying to make work. And I think that we could help you with some of our expertise get that job done. So I'll show you one of the things that we did with Toyota, and then we can talk after that.
If I were to see in the news or a picture of a fire truck with this type of a sensor package on the tip of the ladder, and I see it rescuing somebody out of a building, I mean, that would be the ultimate. It gives me goosebumps now just thinking about it, right? That would be a great thing. So that would be the ultimate reward, I guess.
For decades, Toyota's been developing technologies that have revolutionized the way we drive. And quietly, they've been sharing these innovations with universities, hospitals, and other manufacturers to help improve lives beyond cars. With the Ideas for Good campaign, Toyota shared its innovations directly with the public and challenged them to reimagine uses for those technologies to benefit humanity. To introduce it to the public, we launched the campaign through a series of television spots, as well as print ads and digital media that encourage viewers to submit their ideas on our site. There, the public and a panel of esteemed judges would choose the top 5 ideas to be brought to life by the engineering masterminds at Deep Local and Carnegie Mellon University. The word spread quickly.
Having the ability to pull smoke from one area to another without hooking up to a power grid, that's a major thing. So that is a perfect fit, I think, for Toyota's solar-powered ventilation system.
Went from, you know, extremely unhealthy levels, you know, without the vent to, you know, relatively safe levels with. So, I mean, it was working really well, and it was actually working really quickly. We could see the numbers drop as soon as we started using that vent.
7,000 is dropping now. We're at 6,28,000.
My initial concept was, you take an automated parking guidance system, and instead of helping you park the car, you're helping to park the ladder. It's sort of a suite of sensors that Deep Local has incorporated beyond just positioning the ladder and detecting when you're close to the building and helping to hold it there.
Toyota's told us we can take the ideas and push them forward. So as Prototyping Weekend finishes, it's actually the beginning of exploration for us. And our dream is to take the most promising ideas, work with experts around the world, and think about how we can mature them as much as possible into something that's of real value to society.
And before I hand over to Cindy, those of you who want to follow or tweet about this, if you could use the hashtag DJSTChange. Don't just sell things, change. Cindy, over to you quickly.
Hi, guys. I'm at Cindy Gallup on Twitter. My background is 27 years working in brand building, marketing and advertising, which has left me feeling very strongly about three things. The first is that I want to redesign the future of business. I believe that business of the future should be about doing good and making money simultaneously, and not in the old world order way that businesses currently do it, which goes, we make money here, and then we do good by writing checks to cause us to clear our conscience, but the new world order way of making money because we do good. Finding a way to integrate social responsibility into the way you do business on a day-to-day basis that makes it a key driver of future growth and profitability. The second thing is that I'm a huge believer in radical simplicity. I want to help make it as easy and simple for businesses to do this as possible. And the third is that I believe there is way too much talking in this world and too little doing. So I don't talk, I do. These days, I'm an entrepreneur.
Are you off then, Cindy?
I have two early stage web ventures. If We Ran the World, which is a very simple web meets world platform designed to turn human good intentions and corporate good intentions into collective action, based around a business model of shared values plus shared action equals profit. I have a second venture called Make Love Not Porn. No time to talk about that now, but check it out at makelovenotporn.com. And that has received such an extraordinary response since I launched at TED 3 years ago that I'm taking that forward as a business venture that will launch as makelovenotporn.tv in May. If We Ran the World is out to change the world through collaborative human and corporate action. Make Love Not Porn is out to change the world through sex. I also work alongside both of those ventures as a consultant, only for clients and brands who want to change the game in their particular sector. You come to me for radical, innovative, groundbreaking, transformative. I don't do status quo. My consultancy approach is I like to blow shit up. I am the Michael Bay of business. And finally, because I know that there are a lot of you from the advertising industry in this room, I would also dearly love to help our industry reinvent itself for the future, which is something it is appallingly bad at doing. I have a presentation called The Future of Advertising. If you Google me, you can find it. And I believe that we have to move, as the advertising industry, from making good advertising to making advertising good, to making advertising a force for good and a force for change if we want to have a future. So I also believe you can change the world through advertising.
Bravo.
So you said some big... We'll start with you, Cindy, as you've been very...
Yeah, I don't want to follow that.
Ditto her. Yeah.
So, I mean, it seems to me there's no more difficult industry to take on than the sex industry, the porn industry, because, I mean, that's an industry that that makes a lot of money for people, that there's a lot of profit in it, that is, to many people, an industry that is... shouldn't exist, even. And yet it seems like you feel that there is an ethically sustainable industry that could come out of that industry? Could you just talk about what the issues are there?
I should explain, by the way, that Make Love Not Porn is not anti-porn. I'm pro-porn. I watch it regularly myself. The issue I'm tackling with Make Love Not Porn is not porn. The issue I'm tackling is the complete lack in our society of an open, healthy dialogue around sex and porn that would then allow people to bring a real-world mindset to the viewing of what's essentially artificial entertainment. If you boiled my entire message of Make Love Not Porn down to one thing, it'd be purely and simply talk about it. And I think that's why, in the 3 years since I launched Make Love Not Porn, people have reached out from all around the world, from everywhere, saying, love what you're doing, want to help, including, much to my surprise when this first began happening, a number of people in the porn industry. Specifically, Generation Y in porn. Your generation in porn is like your generation anywhere else. Entrepreneurial, ambitious, questioning and challenging the old world order, want to be a part of the new. So 20-something porn stars and porn directors have reached out saying, we love this initiative, we want to help. And so actually, what I am doing is designed to help the porn industry reinvent its future as well. It's designed to help all of us because I have a very big ambition with MakeLoveNotPorn.tv. I want to take every dynamic that exists out there in social media currently and apply it to the one area that no social media network or platform has ever gone or will ever dare go, which is sex. I would like to socialize real-world sex. I'd like to make real-world sex socially acceptable and socially shareable and therefore talk-aboutable in a way that, to be frank, nobody else has ever achieved to date. And I actually believe that in doing that, I will be able to help the porn industry, which is an industry where, because we never talk about sex, we never talk about porn. Because we never talk about porn, that is an industry where there are no whistleblowers, no one shines a bright light into dark corners in a way that would improve business practices, improve the treatment of talent, and enable that industry to do business in a better way. And I'd actually like to help them do that.
And, I mean, the role of profit in that, because, I mean, some people would say that Yeah, this is an industry that's basically evolved because people see a way to make money off exploiting vulnerable people. You see that the profit could actually save that industry?
Well, I actually see a very different way of making money. And actually, when I launch MakeLoveNotPorn.tv, you'll see that it's designed around a very innovative business model, which actually comes out of my own personal philosophy, which is that people should see the value of the things they create. I feel this very strongly because my background is theater and advertising, both industries where ideas and creativity are massively undervalued, quite often by the players within those industries themselves. And so I believe that as we move with the power of the internet to a world where more and more things are accessible free online, actually everybody should be able to realize the financial value of great things that they create. I want to demonstrate that through MakeLoveNotPorn.tv, and I would like that to be as true within the porn industry as a whole as in any other industry, including advertising.
Okay, I'm going to turn to some other big industries. You talked about, Margaret, you talked about Toyota and how it had this campaign in response to some failures, very embarrassing public failures. Now, I think a lot of people, when they look at this movement that's been going on in the corporate sector over the last few years, corporate social responsibility, corporate citizenship, now shared value is the latest term. They say there's a lot of skepticism about it. All these firms with their environmental statements, it's greenwash, mm-hmm. You join the UN compact, it's blue wash, mm-hmm. And so forth. Hogwash, another one, I'm not sure that's been the pig industry. But it's what have you learned so far about what is genuinely revolutionary, transformational that companies can do as opposed to just being kind of PR in the crudest sense of avoiding the truth?
Yeah, I think, it's nothing new. You guys probably know. It's just, it's to be transparent, to be as transparent as you can about what's going on, and also to have a commitment. Because that takes a lot. That takes a lot on the client side, that takes a lot on your team side, that takes a lot on the leadership, of an agency or a communications group. And I think the thing is, it's pretty great. We're at a pretty amazing, we talked about this yesterday, we're at a great sort of perfect storm right now, because it used to be that, we'd sort of work for years and years and years to do really special things with our clients. And sometimes you get that magical client, right, who comes to you and says, I want to do something really amazing. I don't want to just come to work anymore. I want to really change the world. And they're very visionary. That's a scary client, too, because they don't stick around very long, right? Those clients that have come to me, I know I got a year in them, and then they're off to do something really beautiful and brilliant. A great example of that is Jim Stengel from P&G. Here's a guy who really wanted to change the world, and you knew that we wouldn't get too much time with him on the P&G stuff because he was going to go out and do that.
What did he do at P&G?
He was the director of what? I don't even know, Chris. Do you know what his title was?
What was his project?
Oh, we were doing children's safe drinking water with him. But he was the CMO of all brands, right? So 300 plus brands at P&G. And he came to us when we were working on P&G accounts, on Pure in particular, and they had a little tiny sort of offshoot called Children's Safe Drinking Water. And when my partner Chris and I saw that, we were like, oh, hello, where did that come from, you know? And we just wanted to blow that up. We said, that's the most amazing thing you're doing here, and we want to work on that.
Because it's interesting. I mean, P&G is a company I've looked at quite a lot. Yeah. And I mean, with Pure, this drinking water sachet, I mean, they initially said, let's create a business. You know, sort of, it'd be like sort of the same model as mobile phone ladies in villages selling sachets of water purification. Yeah. And it didn't work as a business for some reason. Yeah. And so now it's been turned into a non-profit and kind of given away.
Yeah, it's
whereas they also have done this project with Pampers where they've, a certain amount of Pampers, the money they raise goes to eradicating a particular childhood disease.
Yeah.
And that seems to have worked incredibly well. Why has one succeeded and one failed? And
The Pure sachets were difficult because what they wanted to do was create sachets and not have it be a handout, right, globally. That for emerging nations or emerging villages and communities, they wanted people to be able to earn it, right? The problem was that there were huge national disasters going on, and come all the time. And what do? You want to go to that place and you want to give away as many sachets as you can. You don't want to just say these people have to earn it and blah blah blah. So I think they were sort of caught, in that area where, when things happened, they wanted to get there and they wanted to get there soon and they wanted to give away tons and tons of packets and not make anybody have to, to do anything for those and just to be there as a to save those guys.
So they didn't really figure out whether they were really trying to create a sustainable business or whether they were
trying to
associate with a good cause.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one, and I think you have to realize that, especially in a place like P&G, you have a lot of people with a lot of different agendas wanting to do a lot of different things. And for the client there that really sees the future for something like that sort of philanthropic endeavor or that sort of causal endeavor, they really have to be tough. I mean, they have to be incredibly strong, and you want to support that person as much as you can in as many ways as you can to be able to do that, There are other times when you don't have those clients that are that ambitious, and you have to find a way to convince them of that ambition and find causes, that they can rally behind. That's when it really takes a commitment. I mean, then you have to stick around. And you have to give them data, and you have to give them stats, and you have to convince them, usually from a consumer insight, that consumers want you to do these things, right? They want you to be transparent. They want you to do good. In fact, they demand it now. And you have to help them sort of realize their vision for that, and it has to be a germane cause, not just something that you sort of pluck out, because you want credit for it. And then you have to commit to it, right? In the olden days, marketers could commit for 6 months, right, or a quarter or something, get credit for it, and then sort of let it go, right? Don't let it get paid for the next year, and don't sort of push it on the agenda, or that particular person moves up the ladder and goes somewhere else. The greatest advent now in the perfect storm I was kind of talking about is social media, because now consumers, they're watching you, They're watching your corporations. They're watching what you do. They can find out how long you've been committed, what you're doing, how you're spending the money. And it's really great because it helps everybody sort of stick to the program and be committed for a certain period of time to those issues or to that philanthropy or to that cause. And that's really what's been brilliant, at least for us in the last couple of years, because they tell you what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong, right? We had done the Pedigree Adoption Foundation through our Pedigree account, and people loved it because...
What did that do?
It raised millions of dollars for shelters all over the country.
For dog shelters.
And you buy a bag at a certain time of year, we donated a bag. And it was great because people got online and told us what we were doing right and what we were doing wrong. I mean, the advent of social was really perfect at that time because you really know what you're doing and you can tweak it, and they appreciate it when you listen to them and you're learning from them and you change the program. And after the first year, the second year, the fifth year, the seventh year, you've actually, made the program and they support you because you've made the changes that they've asked for, right?
One question. I mean, obviously, you're from a marketing perspective, but I mean, my sense is that this really works. Companies really transform themselves when they have a chief executive who is committed to it because they think this is the long-term future of their company. I mean, whether it be someone like Paul Polman at Unilever or Indra Nooyi at Pepsi, that they basically defined their success on achieving a much more positive social role.
Right.
Now, do you see much of that change going on, or is this still, from your perspective, this is really a marketing-led thing about consumer products and so forth?
That's a great question. I think it really is happening. I mean, I think I'm an optimist, so I believe that it's gotten easier and better. The other piece is that we have more information and more data, so that each one of us isn't individually staying up all night trying to put together a deck with data that says that this is what's important to people, right? We have lots and lots and lots of consumer data, a lot of white papers online that just tell us exactly how to do this now, or give us the data that when we go into a meeting, we can convince our partners and our clients that this is the right thing to do. In years past, we'd have to commission those studies, right? We'd have to go to Harvard. We'd have to go somewhere and partner with these guys and spend oodles of money and try and convince these guys to do that stuff. And now we don't. You know, we all have this place on the internet where we can sort of galvanize and use each other's information, you know, to sort of show that this is what's happening and it has to be real and it has to be authentic. And if we misstep, it's better that we don't go there at all, right? I mean, I guess I should rephrase that. We can make mistakes. We can't make huge mistakes, especially when we're talking about people's lives and children and babies and things like that. But I guess as far as marketing, I think people would rather us be brave and transparent than do nothing at all. And if somebody gives you shit online in a comment section that you didn't do something right, you can go back and say, look, man, you know, the dog food might not be perfect, but we're saving fucking dogs, so who cares, right? I don't usually do that under my own name, but, you know, but you know, I mean, it, you know, it's that thing, you know, it's that, you have to be motivated by that, and I think we have to motivate our teams. You have to motivate the kids that are on your teams, you know, to say, what's the greatness that's going to come out of today? You know, you're working on Crest toothpaste, you're working on this, you're working on that. What's the greatness that's going to come out of that? You know, are you going to create a program for kids to teach them how to brush their teeth? You know, because we were talking the other day that these new kids that are being born today are going to live to be 100 years old. 100 years old. So we got to figure out how to make them healthy, to make them safe, you know, and do cool programs that they dig, you know.
Okay, let's bring Neil in. I mean, Neil, I mean, I'm very struck by a real trend to do things that would traditionally have been done as charities or as, you know, fundamentally as not trying to make any profit, are now being done as for-profit enterprises. And you've set up what, on the face of it, could be a classic charity, giving blankets away in partnership with UNICEF. Yeah. And you've structured it as a for-profit. I mean, what's your thinking behind that?
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of consideration given to how we were going to structure, how I was going to structure the business model. I did actually spend a lot of time looking into nonprofit, and we won't dive into nonprofit. Some of you probably are from nonprofit, and it's hindered. It's a flawed business model in a sense that it makes it, the government makes it very difficult for you to do certain things. And what I wanted to do with this is... I just didn't want to, this is not about just giving blankets away. This is about educating people both here and abroad and allowing people access to information. And so where that led me was to a business model which was very much modeled after the Tom Shoes model, which is a one-for-one program.
Everybody knows about Tom Shoes.
Tom Shoes, you buy one, they give one. Our business model is very much that same mechanism. You go to our site, and very soon in retail, I'm glad to say, you can buy a blanket, and when you do that, we will give a blanket to a mother and a newborn in a developing country. So the laws for nonprofits are very strict, and it makes it very difficult for you to make a product and sell it at retail and then distribute that money, which is ultimately what we want to do, is localized manufacturing. So rather than us take the money and make the blankets here, we want to transfer that money to the local economy, say for now, Uganda, localized manufacturing, inject that into their economy, make the blankets there out of indigenous materials and distribute them there. Cuts down on our carbon footprint and our shipping costs, which are adding a tremendous amount to our overall unit price. And it makes it for them. You know, it gives them the opportunity to manufacture it and make it there. So that will that's sort of ultimately how our business model. I want to step back just for a second and say something about the blanket and a little bit about my own personal journey and how it struck a chord with me from deeply internally. I grew up on a small pig farm in western Kentucky, rural western Kentucky. My father was a disabled Vietnam veteran, and we were poor. We didn't have a lot at all. And I remember growing up as a kid, especially when I got into high school, I started running with a crowd that was, they were the rich kids. You know, they were the kids, their doctor, their fathers and mothers were doctors and lawyers and dentists. And I remember thinking to myself, how unlucky I was. You know, how unlucky I was that I was born into this family that that was poor. And I guess ultimately I turned that into motivation to do something to better my life and to use it as fuel to fire my own career. And I guess couched those feelings. And when I went to Uganda and I was in that village, and you saw me there with the kids, that was in Nsasi Village, which is about 2 hours north of Kampala. Very remote Luwero district, bush country. These kids, you know, they're in rags and they've got nothing. I remember it hit me, all those old feelings of it's dumb luck where we're born. It's dumb luck that we're all sitting here. You may be born to a doctor or a lawyer or a prostitute or a drug addict, or you may be rich, or you may be poor, or you may be in India, or you may be in anywhere, Uganda. And I think that was one of the real sort of soulful things that came out of my trip to Uganda was that.
I mean, it seems to me one of the things that is really challenging when you take on an issue like infant mortality, yeah, is, you know, you can figure out a model that works for a village or two villages. I mean, you take Millennium Villages that Jeff Sachs has created.
Yeah.
And you create this fantastic village.
Yeah.
But how do you? But you don't then have a way to scale it up and reach the millions and millions of people. Whereas you look at the business world. And one of the things that the business has got incredibly good at over the last few years is just taking a good idea and very quickly getting it to millions and millions and millions of people.
Yeah.
So, and I had this conversation with the CEO of Coca-Cola that, you know, he was talking about this drink they're making now that it contains all the essential nutrients for young children, young babies to make sure they aren't malnourished.
Yeah.
And they're doing that as a non-profit. But I was saying, you know, basically, you as a company can get sweet sugar water that's quite bad for people to every single part of the planet. How do you take that knowledge and expertise to getting actually a beneficial drink to every part of the planet? And I wonder, as you look at this, you've got the for-profit model, you've got this village in Uganda, you've got the blanket. What are you thinking about in terms of how you're going to scale this up and really make it so that it's, you know, it's far more than you in one village. It's millions of poor people that are being helped to live a better life.
I'm climbing Everest. That's how I look at it. It's not easy. But I keep reminding myself is
but do you have a plan? Do you have a strategy?
Yeah, well, yeah. Of course. I mean, you know, the plan right now is to spread the word, introduce the blanket to as many influential people as I can, try to find angel investors, people that will give me $1 million to do this, which is a drop in the bucket for a lot of people. But for me, would mean that I could really get this off the ground. But let me say this. The thing that I keep reminding myself is that, and I don't say only. I've distributed several hundred, almost 800 blankets. That's, in a world sense, maybe seems insignificant. But if one life was saved, if one life is saved out of that 800, what's the value of that? I've succeeded. So I focus on that. I don't focus on the millions. I don't focus on the hundreds of millions. I focus on the hundreds and maybe a thousands and then the 10,000s. But right now I focus on just trying to sell as many blankets as I can so I can distribute them. Because I think it's easy to get caught up in this, oh, it's only 800. And 800 is a lot, especially if you've saved some lives. So
I had a quick question.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask?
Sure.
What about would you ever partner with a P&G or a Unilever or anybody to really get that mass scale going?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. If it's right, I mean, mm-hmm. I've had conversations with P&G. I've had conversations mm-hmm. with Pampers. I have to be careful because the audience that I have built is a very socially conscious audience.
It's tough.
It's tough. I want to stay true to them.
Yeah.
Pampers, you know, they've got their baggage, and I'm not sure that I want to be attached to that. But I'm not.
It's interesting because I mean, if you look at malaria, which is one of the things I profile in my book, Philanthrocapitalism. I mean, that is an issue where, after years and years and years of trying and making no progress at all, where you had charities giving away bed nets, you had companies making for-profit bed nets, nothing really happened. Then finally, this grand coalition with Ray Chambers at the UN, mm-hmm. ExxonMobil, News International, mm-hmm. The National Basketball Association. I mean, just this vast group of people, churches like Saddle Riverback Church, and so they, all these different places came together and they formed this integrated strategy. And suddenly we're seeing deaths by malaria falling by millions a year.
Exactly.
I mean, and I wonder, do you see that as part of what has to happen in order for infant mortality to be changed?
I think so. And I hope you got it out of the video. You know, there's a lot of contributing factors to infant mortality. Many of them, you know, the number that wasn't on there is Afghanistan at 160. For those of you that didn't catch the first few slides, infant mortality is defined by the number of newborn deaths per 1,000 every year before the age of one, right? So Japan was 3.2, Uganda is 80, Afghanistan is 167, right? So now, the problem with Afghanistan is that it's probably mostly due to war, which is not something that I can affect. So what I have to do is I have to look at areas of the world where infant mortality is high because of lack of information. Bolivia just became South America's number one high infant mortality country, and it was noted in an article in May last year that it was contributed mostly to ignorance. Right, so the lack of information. So I have to look.
So you've really got to pick your markets.
So I have to pick my markets, and I have to focus. I can't go into Afghanistan as much as I want to because the blanket just—it's not about lack of education. So to answer your point, Matthew, which is a good one, yes. Ultimately, for me or for the blanket to succeed or to reach its ultimate potential, is for me to latch onto corporate sponsors. I need an ExxonMobil or a P&G or a NBA, because that ultimately is where the money is going to come from. I can't run it out of my own pocket.
Great. I want to just change tack a bit now.
Sure,
I mean, and then I'm going to throw it open to questions. So if you want to ask a question, could you come to this mic in the middle here, right at the front, and just form a line? The company I'm thinking about hardest at the moment is Apple. I saw a play in New York the other week called The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which is basically about how an Apple addict became aware of the labor process by which his products were made. Mm-hmm. And walking out of the theater, there was a man there shouting, "Death to Apple executives. Take the company away and give it to the people of China," who I assume was mad. But anyway, he was very, very passionate about it. But it does seem like Apple, if all the stuff we're saying is true, that companies have got to change and be transparent and be ethical in how they make their products because consumers want that now and companies are going to play a positive role in the world, that Apple ought to have a hell of a problem at the moment, that it needs to be dramatically changing the way it operates. And I just wonder what each of you would give as advice to Apple at this particular moment in time as it handles this sudden awareness that, they're basically using arguably using child labor or whatever to make our beautifully designed products that we all love. You've worked with Apple, Margaret. Why don't you start?
This is a hard one. I worked on Apple off and on for about 10 years. Created some of the stuff that was, part of the campaigns that happened. So this is a tough one because I owe a lot of my professional fame and all that to Lee Klow and Steve Jobs. So it's a tough one because we did work on it. It did seem pretty phenomenal that things could be built and made in such incredibly short periods of time, And if you have sort of the background that I have or these guys have or some of you guys have, you really think about that and say something's going on here, I think it would be amazing if when we're talking about transparency, if they sort of embraced all of those practices, the good ones and the bad ones, and figured out how to tell that story. I think they have such a radical following, such a true following. I don't know what's going on there. I mean, I know of some of the stuff that's going on in China because we all know. But it would be interesting to talk about it, to socialize that before somebody finds out that stuff and does it for you. I mean, I think that's the whole deal, is to come as clean as you can about everything that's going on and talk about it. I didn't mean to change the Apple subject, but I want to say one really quick thing. When you're talking about your followers and how they would feel about you partnering up with one of these huge corporations, that would be like, I would talk to them, right? I'd get a forum and say, what do you guys want me to do? Yeah. I'm here. I'm at the crossroads. I partner with these guys, and I know that some of you think I'm going to do a deal with the devil, and I get that. But it doesn't, in the grand scope of things, right? This would be amazing for many, many, many people and their families. So, we have this awesome opportunity to socialize our stuff back out to our people.
Cindy, can I get you back to the Apple question?
Sure. No, Apple is fascinating because Apple represents the absolute apotheosis of brand building. If Apple were to announce today...
Wait, we have
today,
to look up apotheosis. Hang on.
If Apple were to announce today that in 3 months' time they'd be launching a new product, and they were not going to tell you what it was, but for anybody who put down a $100 deposit right now, you would have priority ordering. They would have 15 million people paying $100 right now for something they hadn't the faintest idea what it was and whether or not they could use it. Yeah. That is the power of the brand.
Yeah, right.
And so what Apple demonstrates, actually for any company doing this...
Should we announce the eye blanket now?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, here now, the eye blanket.
So what Apple demonstrates for any company doing business in the world today is the extraordinary leeway that building a really great brand gives you. Imagine as a sort of everyday example of that, real apples. Okay, imagine that you buy a pound of apples, and if you live in New York as I do, you might buy a pound of apples from the corner bodega, or you might buy a pound of apples from Dean and DeLuca. So you buy a pound of apples. And one of those apples, when you get it home and take the apples out of the bag, one of those apples is bad. And if it's a pound of apples in the corner bodega, you go, bloody hell, bad apple, bloody typical. Damn. If it's the pound of apples from Dean and DeLuca, you go, oh, a bad apple from Dean and DeLuca, how very unusual. And that is what Apple is leveraging today with all of its problems in China. We love Apple. We think it's brilliant. And so we are going to give them the benefit of the doubt and a whole lot of leeway when it comes to anything involving corporate practices that might not be as great as they could be. And that is actually the power of what certainly all of us at this table and a lot of you in this room do, which is help clients and companies build extraordinary brands. That may not, by the way, be, you know, the best thing in the world when it comes to uncovering dubious practices, but certainly the better and stronger a brand you build with phenomenal products and phenomenal customer service and phenomenal invention of the future, the more leeway you have, because the more forgiving your customers will be whenever you stray off the path.
But so how much leeway do you think they really have? I mean, how many people have to throw themselves off the roof of Foxconn factories before caring?
I think they have as much leeway as they have right now to realize that, you know, as Margaret said earlier, you know, we live in a world today where the new business reality is complete transparency. Every single thing that a brand, company, or for that matter, a person does today is potentially in the public domain courtesy of the power of the internet. And actually, you know, for anyone who is utterly terrified by that prospect, the solution's very simple. If you identify exactly who you are and what you stand for, whether, by the way, you are a company and a brand or a person, and you then only ever behave, act, and communicate in a way that is true to you, then you never have to worry about where anybody comes across you or what you're found doing, because by definition, you're never found doing anything to be ashamed of. And so for Apple, the opportunity is to actually do a bit of self-examination and self-reflection and go, we've built this extraordinary brand, but are we reflecting it in absolutely everything we do in a world of complete transparency? And they have the leeway to address that very, very fast before it gets any worse.
Do you want to come in on this, Neil?
Yeah. I do. Well, I'm an Apple diehard. I have been since I was a youngin, and grew up on Apple. And I agree with Cindy. I think the solution is very simple. You're manufacturing in China for a fraction of what you could do it in the U.S. Okay, I get it. You also have liquid more cash than the U.S. government. You have got to be up the asses of the factories in China to make sure that the standards and quality of working conditions are at par with U.S. or better. And there's no reason for them to be sitting on billions and billions and billions of dollars. And people, we all love our hand-polished shit, right? It's all hand-polished. You guys know that? Like, everything is hand. It's all done by hand. Those perfect displays, the backs of the iPads, all hand-done. And people are dying of aluminum dust in their lungs or committing suicide because their hours are so long. So Apple's got to go in there. If they're going to continue to manufacture out of China, they've got to go in there and they've got to make sure that those working conditions are supreme. And they can do it. It's really simple.
The one thing I was going to say is I don't think they're going to do it. And I don't think the guy from Coke is going to do it. I think that's when we get involved.
Well, then I think they'll pay for it. I think they'll pay for it.
But we get involved. We go online. We say, this is what we want you to do. And it's one
that's
person,
right.
And then it's 10.
That's right.
And then it's 100,000. We say, this is what we want you to make. We want you to make the cola that takes care of all our kids instead of rots their teeth. We just want you to do that. And if you don't do it, and then the if you don't do it conversation happens, right? But that's the power now.
Yeah, I agree.
Great.
Yeah.
Right? Let's take a question here. Just say who you are.
My name is Ryan. I'm from here in Austin. Is this on?
Yep.
Supreme Court ruling here in the U.S., Citizens United, allowed corporations to get a little bit more involved in politics and policy. Those of you that speak to companies, do you think there would be a trend for some of these companies to work within a policy structure of government, rather than setting up a nonprofit foundation to solve the problem? And if the answer is yes, what are those conversations look like? And if the answer is no, what is it about that conversation that drives it to no?
Okay, this I think is an incredibly important question. Thank you. Because one of the things that clearly has happened because the law has changed is that corporates have the power to play a much more active role as political actors in America than they've ever done before. And there is a real sense of, is anything they do through lobbying and so forth and spending money in that way going to actually be in any sense about making the world better in the way that we've been talking about for this. And I think one of the issues I've been writing about is how aggressively companies are lobbying against shareholder initiatives to get them to disclose how they're spending their money in the political process. There's massive discrepancy between companies as to who discloses what, and many don't disclose how they're using their donations. So I don't know, have any of you on the panel got thoughts particularly on you know, what policies companies how they can whether they should be using this money in the political process, and what policy guidelines ought to make sure that is being done in a good way? Neil?
My feeling is they won't. My feeling is that it's an open door to corruption. And I would say that it'll be overturned. I think this will play out for a few years, and then I think it's going to be overturned. Because I think there's too many people that are upset about it. I mean, look at what's going on. It's incredible. So I don't think any good can come out of it. And as far as I've read, or you know, I'm trying to stay fairly well informed, no one's even looking at how it could possibly be for the good. It's mostly about how we can direct power and gain more power and put people in place that we know will be allies of what we want as a corporation.
Do either of you want to come in on this one?
I just want to say that I believe that companies lobbying political governance to make things happen are looking in the wrong direction. I think that corporations should be looking within themselves, identifying exactly what it is that they stand for, what they should be doing that flows out of the nature of their business, what they do on a day-to-day basis, and the responsibility that places upon them, and pursuing that. So I have to say also that the ability to make transparent the inner workings of the political system as much as corporations will actually also increasingly expose the many very dubious practices in this area that we don't get to see. And so I'd like to see all of that turn companies back upon self-reflection and identifying what it is that they can do themselves that could help better the world.
I was just going to say, Ryan, I think that's a great idea for a panel next year.
Yeah.
Next year is going to be
great.
Nuts, and that's sign it up. You know, that should be your panel, because by next year it's just going to be, you know, a radical discussion. So
we will have seen the outcome of it. So you know,
I mean, I think one of the interesting proposals that Richard Branson has is to, many of you will know he has this. He's created this group called the Elders that is a group of people like Desmond Tutu and Jimmy Carter and others that support. Political leaders around the world when they're going through really difficult decision-making processes. He's trying to create the business elders, to create a group of 20 business leaders who can provide guidance to the business community in these difficult decisions. Now, I think they're having tremendous difficulty finding anyone that would have the kind of public credibility that someone like Desmond Tutu did, and I think this is part of the challenge that business faces, that when they come to politics, it's usually they're on the bad side rather than on the good side. One more question here, and then we're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately.
Hi, my name is Megan Stone. I had a question just about how we do business. I think often we can look at people in low-income or developing countries as people we're seeking to help instead of equals. You know, I look around this room, and I would love to see, like, African tech leaders here, like, that some of the, you know, the sponsors would have, you know, given them scholarships to come. Do you have conversations with the big brands that you're interacting with about changing how they do business? You know, when we look at the MDGs, we're celebrating we have global poverty, but when you take out China, the numbers look a lot different. So it's how can we create some of those industries in Africa instead of us doing products that are charitable, cultivating industry? Because there's consumers there that want to buy good products. We see the explosion of mobile phones and other tech solutions. How can we cultivate that at a corporate level?
Yeah, white man's burden sort of thing, right? That's a great question. I think it's happening. It's already happening. You know, in some of the meetings and the things that I've had, these corporations are being forced to address those sort of issues because they don't want it to come off as greenwashing. They have to be more committed in a global way. I mean, a lot of these guys, they do business globally. So sometimes they're actually better informed than we are in North America. You know, when you get in some of the global committees or on, you know, sort of the global SWATs and stuff, they actually educate all the kids, all the guys from North America about those issues. The other thing is they have a lot of partnerships. So they have a lot of voices, you know, so there are a lot of voices that are saying the things that you're saying, making sure that they're sort of top of mind of everybody who's working on the products and the projects. So we don't just sort of get holed up in our little corner and think we're doing great good and being charitable and all that sort of stuff. So it happens more than you'd think. I think they're more aware of it than you think. Unfortunately, like today, yeah, there should be more people here and more people doing more things. We were talking, we had a great discussion the other day about Girl Scouts, you know. And just why all the Girl Scouts, you know, it just, Girl Scouts began, you know, with moms and those, I mean, with moms who started Girl Scouts and then their kids, if their kids were all white, you know, their kids got to be the Girl Scout leaders when their kids were born and so on and so on and so on. And so there are issues like that, that you have to go in there and actually rearrange that and create leaders that are important, that represent all of us, right? And I think that's never going to end. I think we always will have to do that. But I think as far as corporations are concerned, they're actually more aware of that than you think, and taking pretty big strides to correct those issues. I don't know what's going on with South by Southwest, but if that's something that you think is important, we should change it and get more involved.
I mean, one thing that's clearly happening is that you know, cell phone technology in Africa is opening up all sorts of business opportunities. Yeah. And a lot of that is indigenous to Africa, and it's local business people are able to use that technology and innovate in all sorts of really interesting ways. The first cell phone billionaire to come out of Africa is a guy called Mo Ibrahim, and it's interesting that the thing that he has done as his philanthropy has been to address the issue of corruption and bad government in Africa. And I think that's a reminder, when there's this current mindset that aid is all bad, that we just focus on profit as the solution, that actually you have to address the context in which business takes place. And for many small businesses, particularly in Africa, the fact that the business environment is so corrupt makes it really hard, even if you're a great entrepreneur, to really succeed. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our time is up almost, but I just want to ask each of our panelists to offer one challenge for the year ahead, as you think mm-hmm. about this issue of how do you go beyond just selling things to changing the world. Yeah. Neil, in a sentence.
Very quickly, don't underestimate yourself. If you've got an idea, do it. Either collectively or individually, do it, because it can make a difference.
Margaret.
That's great. Figure out how you can be as persuasive as possible and teach everybody around you how to be persuasive as well. Corporations want to make money at the end of the day, and we want to do good. So figure out, you know, sometimes you may have to compromise some things for, you know, the greater good. So remember that.
If you are crafting a business solution for a client or starting up a business, propose or design a business model that demonstrates the more good you do, the more money you make, and the more money you make, the more good you do.
Great. Well, on that note,
thank you guys. Thanks for staying.